This is Julian H. Franklin, and we are moving to the seventh of a series of 10 discussions with C. Northcote Parkinson, a distinguished author, historian, and political scientist, on the evolution of political thought and on the political cycle. In our last talk with Dr. Parkinson, you expressed many doubts about the future of democracy, and you said that the trend to dictatorship, which you note in the present age, has begun to cast some very, very important doubts upon the illusion of permanence and inevitability in the march of democracy. Would you care to illuminate that prejudice and your ideas as to why it's becoming an illusion?
I think I'm going to resent this term prejudice.
That prejudice in favor of democracy.
Oh, I thought you were imputing a prejudice to me. I can't allow that. No, I think the way I'd look at it is this. If you'd taken some statesman of, shall we say, Gladstone's period in England, the Victorian age, he'd have said, in the past there were monarchies and empires and aristocracies, but the tendency of the age now, and he'd have been speaking of Europe and America and of the world in general, is towards enlightened democracy. Or I think he'd have said parliamentary rule, perhaps, rather than democracy at that time. And he'd have seen the salvation of the world in terms of registering electors and putting up ballot boxes and candidates standing for election and parliaments settling down to discuss the budget. For a time, that would have been quite plausible. One could have said that 100 years ago, there was scarcely any sort of parliamentary government in that sense. Now, parliamentary government is to be seen in England and in the United States, in France, at least after 1871. You could say that. The beginnings of it in Germany, Austria, Hungary, you could see a whole tendency towards parliamentary rule. One country after another adopting it or taking a step in that direction. You certainly can't say that of the 20th century. You can no longer look upon it as an inevitable progress of all countries moving towards this same form of rule. Instead, you find this quite different picture of a whole lot of countries adopting something entirely different. Several countries adopting parliamentary government and then abolishing it again. And then this long list of countries finding in dictatorship apparently a solution, perhaps a short-term solution, to their immediate problems.
Of course, in the etymological sense of the word, a dictatorship and monarchy are very close in meaning. I wonder, how do you discriminate the two?
Well, in doing so, I'm following the Greeks. The Greeks had a word for it. And you always find in Greek literature that you have the one man, the basileus, and the other quite different man, the tyrannos. And the difference is in the religious sanction behind the king who has succeeded in accordance with the custom of the country, either by descent or perhaps by election, but at any rate in some established mode and after some prescribed religious form. And the basileus is the man for whom there is a veneration, a religious veneration, as for the rightful ruler. The tyrannos is the man who has made himself ruler by force and cunning. The difference may seem slight to some, but I think it's a useful distinction.
In other words, you mean that the tyrant would be a usurper?
Well, he might be in the sense that he had displaced the rightful king, or he might be in having set himself up as ruler in a state which didn't ordinarily have a king at all.
That's
but
right.
He'd still be tyrannos.
So that tyrant, as the Greeks use it, doesn't necessarily mean a vicious ruler.
No, he's not necessarily vicious. Nor does dictator, in modern usage at least to me, imply a bad ruler. Or a tyrannical ruler.
Well, you were saying why do you think the distinction is an important one between tyrant and king.
Yes, well, it turns on this question of religion, really, the religious function of kingship, which is inherent in the nature of it.
I noticed that in almost all of your critical distinctions and explanations, you find religion perhaps the most powerful factor in explaining the changes of the forms of rule.
I'm unconscious of having brought it in frequently, but perhaps I was right to do so.
When would you say that dictatorship begins to appear as a phenomenon, a widespread phenomenon in the modern world?
Well, of course, the word, as you realize, comes from ancient Rome and meant originally an office of a temporary kind filled to meet a particular emergency. I think the first dictator in the modern world is Oliver Cromwell, where you have the classic form of a monarchy, the king killed, the monarchy swept away, and another man coming into office as ruler, but not king. And you remember with Cromwell, he didn't claim to be king. He didn't take the title. He called himself Lord Protector. And that, in fact, brings out very clearly this distinction between king and dictator.
Well, how did Cromwell conceive his function as Lord Protector? What was he attempting to achieve by assuming this extraordinary power?
Well, I think, like most other dictators, his basic motive was to save his own life. He was a man who, by his military skill, ended off as the successful commander of one side in a civil war. By his skill as a cavalry leader, he won that war. He then lost patience with his colleagues in various ways, whom he thought stupid. In fact, they were. He pushed them aside and made himself ruler. And his first motive in making himself ruler was safety, because he conceived at the start that he and his friends would live in peril as long as the rightful king, Charles I, was alive. So his desire was to kill him, to execute him. He saw to it that that was done.
Well, how does that square with the example of Washington, who was in a similar position, military power, leader of a successful revolution, and declined the dictatorship or refused to seek it? I think we might find other examples from history, but perhaps this one's enough to make my point.
It does make a point, but it brings out the essential difference that Washington was at the head of a very largely united people. He was not the leader of a minority party. He was the leader of, I think we can definitely say, a majority. And he'd very little to fear from assassination or judicial murder or anything of the kind. Cromwell was not in that position. He wasn't at the head of a united people, but he was at the head of a successful army. And for him to have retired, to have handed over the government to someone else, would have been death. He knew that.
Well, a dictator, after all, has various ways of achieving his safety in terms of his long-range objectives, in terms of his notion of what the future of the state might be. Couldn't one say that perhaps Cromwell was thinking of his dictatorship as a preparation for democracy?
It's awfully difficult to say that. What we can say with certainty is that Cromwell, whether he knew it or not, was preparing for a return to monarchy. Mm-hmm. And by the time of his death, the whole situation was so obviously pointing towards the restoration of monarchy that it came about by mutual consent, with very little friction, very little trouble.
Well, do you think that dictatorship inherently tends to prepare the way for monarchy?
It can very easily do so. Again, I wouldn't represent this as anything inevitable.
I was careful to use the word tend.
Yes, I noticed that. I appreciated that. But it very often produces monarchy. There are many examples of it. And you can see that there are features of it which account for that tendency. First of all, the dictator, by the nature of things, can't retain office for more than his lifetime, so that his rule is going to be temporary in that sense. Well, what's going to happen when the dictator dies? It's most unlikely that there will be another dictator of equal ability, because your first dictator does not, as a rule, like to have people of equal ability, equal military prestige near him. He would rather be surrounded by relative nonentities, the people who will serve, people who are useful. He doesn't want people of equivalent stature around him. And the result is that when he dies, it's most unlikely that there will be some other dictator ready to step into his place. The Chinese had some mechanism for ensuring this, which was rather peculiar to them. In general, the dictator dies and there is a blank. Well, ordinarily you'd say, why not restore some kind of aristocratic government? But again, the dictatorship hasn't prepared people for that. People in general, and after a spell of dictatorship, are not used to governing themselves, either aristocratically or democratically. They're used to being governed. And their tendency, when the dictator dies, is to do two things. Either to restore some earlier monarchy, if there is any chance of doing so, or to take the son of the dictator and say, this is the beginning, in effect, of a new dynasty. And of course, once you've done that, you take the son of the dictator. In France, you take a Napoleon III, the nephew of the original dictator originally. And then, of course, you're going back to the concept of monarchy, but just by a different route.
Well, do you think that Bolivar, whom you regard as one of the origins, at least of the Latin American type of dictator, do you think that he had to take political power or monopolistic power in order to save his life?
I wouldn't say in that case that that was his principal motive. He seems to have been a remarkable man in many ways, and very possibly he didn't even value his life very highly, and there are men who take a broader view, so to speak, and are not as worried about their skins as Cromwell was. But there, I think, you get a situation which seems insoluble in any other way. Bolivar tended to get sort of pushed back into office by the mere absence of any body of people or any alternative ruler who would take his place. That may be another way in which a dictatorship is perpetuated.
He had the feeling, in other words, that the Venezuelan people or the Colombian people were not yet ready for democracy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they clearly weren't.
Yes, that was the grounds of his taking the dictatorship.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Couldn't we distinguish dictatorships as between, let's say, revolutionary and counter-revolutionary? For example, isn't there a tremendous difference between the aims of a Robespierre and the aims of a Franco? And for that matter, as between a Lenin and a Mussolini? And wouldn't perhaps these differences in objectives lead to differences in organization, technique, and ideology?
You might think that they would, but in practice I don't see that they do very much. I distinguish from the beginning between the dictator who is, say, the leader of the working class or the leader of a depressed body of the people. Julius Caesar was that originally. Rather, he played that game a bit, although he very soon found other bases for power. And, of course, you have the other kind, the reactionary dictator, the man who is leader of the oligarchs, the more prosperous party. And they are different in origin, I quite agree, and you might expect them to behave very differently. But in fact, it's the circumstances of dictatorship which dictate what they're to do. I agree that there can be differences in character, but the basic facts of dictatorship still remain. First, that the office was achieved in the first place usually by violence. There might be some instances to the contrary, but it's usually been violently created as a form of rule. Second, that it can't last longer than the life of the man who's holding it, and mayn't last as long, and incidentally his life may not be terminated in the natural way in any case. People sometimes anticipate that, shorten the process. That's not unknown in the story of dictatorships, so that it's a short-lived form of rule. And there you have two basic considerations. And the third one, which is again common to any form of dictatorship, is this difficulty of replacing it by something else, the dictator's difficulty in stepping down.
But in Russia, of course, there was a relatively smooth transition from Stalin to Malenkov to Khrushchev. Doesn't that cast doubt upon this principle of the dictator being unable to transmit power to a successor?
I've always considered the Russian experience as proof that that is not a dictatorship. I know there are people who would disagree with me, but in writing about it, I've classed the Russian experiment as one in theocracy, or rule of a priesthood. And the way some writers have certainly considered the matter is this, that the actual power in Russia after Lenin's time came into the hands of a strong group of bureaucrats, party leaders, chiefs of police, and other powerful men. And they discovered that for purposes of propaganda, for purposes of focusing the loyalty of the people at large, they had to choose one of themselves and build him up in a public relations sense, build him up as a character, put his picture before the people as that of the actual leader of the state. And I think that is, in fact, what happened to Stalin.
Well, perhaps I can illustrate my point from the history of Rome. Julius Caesar, of course, was assassinated, but primarily because he tried to make the transition to monarchy a bit too quickly, too. But Augustus, Caesar's nephew, was successful in transmitting power, and for about 100 or 200 years, the regime still seemed to be a dictatorship and not quite yet a monarchy, and yet power was constantly transmitted, not always peaceably, with some violence on occasion, and yet institutionally transmitted from one dictator to another.
Yes, it was rather a checkered career there. For a time it seemed that the thing was hereditary, or if not hereditary, that it was within a certain family with a certain latitude as to who the successor was to be. And then it sort of changed at intervals after that into the hands of one victorious general after another. And they seem to have solved the matter from the Roman point of view almost in the Russian manner when one considers it, by making the emperor divine. That happened fairly soon in the process when the emperor was deified and people sacrificed before the emperor's statue.
Yes, but only after his death, of course. And real theocracy probably doesn't begin until a somewhat later period.
Yes, but that sort of gave a religious sanction to the whole thing, and they seem to have managed to create a continuity in the imperial office, which managed to override the shifting as between one dynasty and another, one family of another, actually in power.
You know, the German sociologist Max Weber has said that almost all dictatorships are charismatic, and by that he meant that the leader somehow seems to have the grace of God, the magic in him. In that sense, couldn't you say that perhaps all dictatorships are proto-theocratic anyway? I would cite as an example Hitler.
Yes, he certainly thought that he had a sort of inspiration and that he embodied in himself the spirit of the German people. But of course it still doesn't get over the question of when he dies. There was no successor to Hitler, there was no successor in sight. Hitler didn't even think there was a successor.
But yet the German dictatorship, you said, was in some sense quasi-theocratic. But are you then dealing with a case in which there was a theocracy which didn't quite permit succession easily?
I don't think that it was a very successful theocracy. I think the Russian one is far more so. And the way that power has changed hands there without civil war and changed hands successively seems to me to show that there is a greater strength in the group that runs the Communist Party in Russia than in any one individual in it.
Can you give us some examples of cases where succession proved impossible?
Yes. I don't know whether Napoleon I is a good case there or not. He was certainly a very difficult man to succeed, even had he not been defeated. There was no obvious way of continuing the reign, although he was struggling to make it a hereditary monarchy. That's what he wanted it to be.
Hitler and Mussolini was never tested in their case. Where has it been tested?
Cromwell is one. I'm afraid I haven't followed all the South American dictatorships.
Yes,
that's a very confused story.
Bolivar, in a quotation you've taken from him, makes the point that it's people rather than systems that promote tyranny. That quotation seemed to be in an approving context.
I'm afraid I don't remember the context. You've read this book more recently than I have.
Oh, about 20 minutes ago.
Yes, well, that puts you in a strong position. Bolivar certainly felt that the people wanted his dictatorship and needed his dictatorship, and that that was his justification for carrying on with it.
I think his context there was that it's the moral qualities of a population, in the last analysis, as opposed merely to the social and political mechanisms which determines whether a country's going to have freedom or tyranny.
Yes, well, that's quite arguable, but as an historian, I'm always very dubious about lending weight to this idea of national character. It's so easy to end off saying, well, the Germans have no real gift for governing themselves, therefore they must always have a monarchy or a dictatorship and are going to be unhappy under anything else. Or you could say that the Irish are such a turbulent lot of people that you'd never expect them to form a stable government. And you can go on trying to think what the moral or natural qualities are of peoples. And I'm never very happy about that. I'm much happier if I can find some real circumstances which are more beyond question than that. If you can find economic and physical and geographical circumstances, I'm much happier than talking about the innate moral qualities of the people of Bolivia, because that seems to me far more difficult to assess.
I'd like to throw out one more to you. The term dictatorship, as you said, comes from Rome, dictator. A dictatorship there was a regular office of the state. Would you call an office of that sort a dictatorship? And would you say that the emergency powers exercised by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, or perhaps Bruning in Germany from 1930 to 32, made them dictators?
No, I wouldn't strictly. I think that in particular circumstances, someone who has come into power by perfectly constitutional means has to assume rather greater power for the period of an emergency. I'm sure that Winston Churchill was a far more powerful prime minister than his predecessors. I'm sure that he was able to take far greater responsibilities on his own shoulders.
And say during the war had practically dictatorial powers.
It was of the war period that I was speaking.
Yes.
And I'd say there perhaps dictatorial is putting it too strongly. Mm-hmm. But he certainly had quite unusual powers. I imagine the same could be said of Roosevelt. And the same of Stalin, incidentally. Although people on this side of the Iron Curtain have been perhaps reluctant to see that Stalin's power in Russia was as likely to arise from the situation as Churchill's power in Britain. I don't regard that as of the same order of things as the actual seizure of power in a period of disorder.
So that the concept of usurpation becomes decisive for you. Of course, the Middle Ages had a dual concept of dictatorship or tyranny. One came from the absence of a title, which would cover usurpation, and the other, by the way, exercised its power. Would you use the category tyrant, dictatorship, for a monarch who had violated the principle of law or the moral basis of his authority?
Well, you may remember how in Henry V, Shakespeare makes his king say, "I am no tyrant, but a Christian king," showing that the concept of the tyrant as contrasted with the lawful king was present in people's minds. And I think that the Middle Ages made the concept more easy in the sense that the wicked king could be excommunicated by the church and so have his particular religious sanction of monarchy removed from him. And I think that the monarch who was so excommunicated did in fact lose a great deal of his authority by that excommunication.
In a rather cryptic passage, you said that without an earlier period of monarchy, sometimes, the later development of democracy may be impossible. You were thinking of South America. You felt at that point that in view of endless cycle of dictatorships in South America, they might have done better to start with a monarchy.
What I had in mind there was the creation of the unit within which an aristocracy or a democracy can be created. Let's put it this way. In a democracy, the rule depends on a counting of heads, deciding how many people want this and how many want that, and it ends at some sort of a vote. Now, you can't vote until the area within which the voting is to take place has been defined. This is very much in my mind at the moment because Malaya is a case in point, the country with which I've been familiar for some years. Now there has come into being a new state with various groups of people living in it. Now, the relative strength of those groups depends very much where you draw the frontier. And until that frontier has been drawn, the voting is meaningless. In fact, it's impracticable. Now, in that particular case, the island of Singapore is not now part of the Federation of Malaya. If it were part, if you adjust the frontier to include it, there's another 1.5 million Chinese thrown into the scales, tipping them quite definitely as against the Malays. Now, at an earlier stage in the history of the same country, the Chinese, in fact, had a majority on the peninsula itself, merely because the frontier was then drawn further south. In other words, take the area as a whole, the question of whether there is a Chinese or a Malay majority depends very much on where you draw the line. What is the actual area in which the voting, or in this case the population distribution, is to be counted? Now, it's the same in any state where there is any question of where the thing begins or ends.